Okay, hindrances. Okay, we've talked about what they are. Sensual desire, ill will, sloth and drowsiness, restlessness, anxiety, and uncertainty. Okay. And the question is, how are you going to starve them? This passage here comes from a sutta where the Buddha is talking about how people sometimes will feed their hindrances and feed them with inappropriate attention. In other words, you're not looking them at them as hindrances to begin with. The very first step is to realize, okay, this is a state of mind I don't want to go with. And a lot of times that's half the battle right there. Usually sensual desire comes up and says, ah, candy. Ill will comes up and says, yeah, that person really deserves it. You know? Sloth and torpor, drowsiness come up and says, boy, I'm sleepy, this is time for me to get a rest. Restless and anxiety, this is something I really got to worry about. And uncertainty, of course, everybody, you know, nobody, who knows about anything out there? And then you can justify these attitudes to yourself very easily. And so the first thing you've got to do is recognize these really do get in the way. And so that's what they call it, is fostering appropriate attention, is to see them as hindrances and then focus on something that will help overcome them. In this case, it's what they call the theme of unattractiveness. In other words, you look for what's not attractive about the object, one. And you're looking for what's not attractive about sensual desire itself. The first one is basically to get, is for the sake of getting at the second one, because the second one is the real problem. Because for most of us, if, you know, we have a sensual desire for something, and it turns out we can't get it, well, we'll settle for a substitute. As long as I got something I can desire, okay, that's the attitude. The Buddha says, you know, it's the desire that we're more attached to than the object. This is the opposite of what was. Did you read that book, Open Desire? Sylvia's practice came out. Mark Epstein wrote about Buddha's attitudes toward desire. He got everything backwards. He was saying desire is great as long as you're not attached to the object. Which sounds like a recipe, you know, for sexual, you know, serial sexual effect. Go for this one, I can't get that one, go to the next one. Now, the real problem is actually our attachment to the desire itself. But first, we have to realize that the object is not worth it. This is where we focus on the theme of unattractiveness. You've probably seen that, where they have what they call the charnel ground meditations, where you visualize the fact that this body is just like a corpse. It's going to be that way someday. With John Fuller, when he had students who would sometimes would meditate, they get a vision of their body. He'd have them say, okay, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15, 20, I mean, what is it going to look like? When it dies, what is it going to look like? And then you start thinking about it, the first day, the second day, the third day, the fourth day. And then we find it, and then finally get to the point where it's been cremated and there's just dust. And then he's okay, now bring it back together again, bring it back to the present to see that, you know, what you've got right here, right now, is very closely connected with that. It's not that far away. And then apply the same thought to anybody else that you're attracted to. That's one way of dealing with it. Another way is just to go through the body and say, okay, which part in here is the part that I'm lusting for? And first you check out your own body. How about my intestines? Is there something really attractive about my intestines? No. You go through the various parts and say, which one? Which one would be okay if I saw a pile of it on the floor when I came to the room? Now, a lot of people resist this because they say you're fostering a negative body image or people are suffering from negative body image. From the Buddhist point of view, there are four kinds of body image. There's healthy positive, unhealthy positive, healthy negative, unhealthy negative. Unhealthy negative is the first one is everybody else is beautiful, I'm ugly. Healthy negatives, we're all ugly. There's nothing to get worked up about. No reason to be jealous about anybody's beauty or lack of beauty, because if you peel away the paint, there's not much there in the house that you want. Unhealthy positive is I am more beautiful than those other people. And that's unhealthy because that's such a fragile perception. Because when the body itself is always ready to betray it, it starts getting older, showing wrinkles. Secondly, you know, someone a lot better looking than you could walk into the room at any time. There's that story they tell of the Buddhist half-sister who, she saw the rest of her family was ordaining as monks and nuns, as she ordained as well. But she was, you know, she was pretty good looking. And you know, she'd go and see the Buddha, and the Buddha was always talking about the unattractiveness of the body. And so she'd always sit at the back of the, crowd where she couldn't hear him. You know the story? And so one day the Buddha said, okay, I've got to get to her, and she's not listening to me. So he created this vision of two really beautiful women on either side of him, fanning him. And they were more beautiful than she was. And she looked at him and went, gosh, they're gorgeous. Like, they're more beautiful than I am. This is horrible. What is it? And then, okay, he saw that he got her attention. This isn't the commentary, it's not the canon thing. Got their attention. Then he had them, the visions grow older and older and older and die and fall to the ground. And that's when it hit her, okay, even though I'm all this beautiful, it will happen to me too. So she got over her pride. So the whole idea of basing your sense of self-worth on how good you look, you're setting yourself up for a fall. And this can be quite subtle. Years back when I was a brand new monk, some people called the monastery one day and their father was dying of liver cancer and they wanted us to come and visit him at the hospital. So I was one of five monks who went along. And the senior monk started talking to the man. He was dying of liver cancer, talking about how it's time to sort of let go of your concern for your body and focus on training your mind, because when the pain comes, it's bad enough now, but it's going to get worse, but you don't want your mind to be affected by it. And he said, it's not the pain, it's the embarrassment. And it turned out he had been a real fitness fanatic. And he had always been very proud of the fact that as he was getting older, his friends were getting paunchy and everything, but he was not, he was still fit and trim and everything. And now his liver was all bloated up and he was all swollen and he was very embarrassed about it. I kept thinking, what, the last thing you want to be worried about when you're dying is embarrassment over your looks. And then I was riding back from the hospital, and I was being raised, wait a minute, that's me. Because I would say I was fitness nut, but I was always proud of the fact that I wasn't getting fat like my friends had. And I realized that's a stupid thing to be proud about. I mean, if you want to stay fit for the sake of your health, but not for the sake of your looks. And it's a very subtle distinction you have to be careful about. Because otherwise, if your looks are part of your sense of self-worth, the body's going to betray you pretty quickly.
Yeah.
There was an article that appeared in a magazine recently, a woman who had been to Burma to practice meditation, and the monks had told her to do body contemplation, and she felt that this was the monks were trying to make her feel bad about herself. And so she, in defiance, said, I'm going to think about how beautiful my body is. My body needs my love and attention, care. And she began to realize that the body was not cooperating very well. Every time a new wrinkle appeared, she had to up the... And I kept thinking, your body doesn't care. I mean, the body's the one that's making the wrinkles to begin with. You know? So what you have to learn how to do is develop a positive, healthy image, which is, you've got this body, you can do lots of good with it. As a human being, you can do all kinds of things that animals can't do. You've got a hand, you can grasp things. You've got a heart that can be generous and give things. You've got the opportunity to observe the precepts. You've got the opportunity to practice meditation. These are all good things you can do with the body. The Buddha doesn't have you look down on the body. Yes, you just have, as I said, a healthy attitude toward it. The healthy negative and the healthy positive, and they work together. Any questions on that? So that's looking at the unattractiveness of the body. As for the unattractiveness of sensuality, the Buddha has lots of analogies for sensual desire. I didn't put them in the list, but I'll give you some of them. One of the examples is of sensuality, he says, is like a piece of meat. You know, a hawk gets a piece of meat and it flies off with the meat, but the other hawks come and they attack it. And the crows come and they attack it. If you don't let go of it, you're going to die. In other words, you get something really good, and people are going to attack you. They're going to want it. Another analogy the Buddha gives is that sensuality is being like borrowed goods. You borrow somebody's really nice, well, they said chariot in those days, you borrow somebody's nice car, mm-hmm. and their nice gear. You go drive it around in a nice car. And they can take it back at any time. And then where are you? And that's the same way your sensual pleasure depends on getting something that really doesn't belong to you. It could leave you at any time. Sensuality, the Buddha compares to a drop of honey on the blade of a knife. We all know that one. He compares it to a dream, a beautiful place you see in a dream when you wake up and it's gone. He compares it to a tree full of fruit. And you see the fruit up in the tree and you climb up and you get the fruit. And someone else comes along and says, I've got all this fruit up in the tree. I don't know how to climb, but I do have an axe. I can cut the tree down. You better get out of that tree as fast as you can. So these are some of the drawbacks of sensuality. So if you pay appropriate attention to that, in other words, you look at sensuality under the context of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, where's the stress here? What's causing the stress? What can I do to put an end to that? That helps get you past the sensual desire. One technique that I used that helped, I found helpful, was something like that comes up in the mind, and I say, well, this is like a movie. If this actually were a movie, would I pay to see it? Probably not. And I say, why am I spending my time watching this? Same with ill will. Lack of food for the arising of unarisen ill will, for the growth of increase of ill once it has risen. It's called the release of the mind. Now, this is basically the release of the mind through the development of the Brahma Viharas. Goodwill, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. Now sometimes it's really hard to feel goodwill for somebody who's mistreated you. And so the Buddha in another passage says, what you can do is think about, if you act on this anger, you're going to do something really stupid and you're going to please that person. Do you want to please that? He didn't say that in quite these words, but do you want to please that bastard? Basically, no. Okay, so I'm not going to act on the anger. Whatever. That's your first defense. He said that you've got a good reason for not wanting to act on the anger. And learn how to see that not acting on anger, you've actually won. I don't know how much it is in Thailand anymore, but it used to be in Thailand that if you showed your anger in public, you lost. It's not that way anymore, but it's, it used to be very strong. Years back, I've been living in Thailand for 2 years, and I was on my way back to the States, so I'm still a lay person. And I took an Air France flight, landed in Paris, and they just opened Charles de Gaulle. And then I took a flight up to London, and we get into London, and everybody on the plane who had flown that flight from Bangkok to Paris and came up to London, the luggage was still in Paris. And so we had to line up and fill out all these forms. It turned out, I think it was the ambassador from Vietnam had just arrived, and so the person who normally looked after baggage claims like that was taking care of the ambassador. And they got this other ground stewardess in. And the line was long, and it was awfully slow, and people started complaining. And she snapped back. She said, you are fortunate that I am here. Basically, it's shock. And I'm thinking, I'm back in the West. I could never imagine a Thai air stewardess speaking like that. So you have to see, okay, the fact that you are not going to show your anger and will, that's a victory right there, number one. Then you realize, okay, how do I strengthen that determination? This is when you start bringing in these practices of the Brahma Viharas. I'll just touch on some of the points briefly. There's the new book back there, Sublime Attitudes, which you might want to get a copy of. And if there are not enough copies, just write us and let us know we'd like a copy. A couple of the main points I made in that book. Number one, goodwill, metta, is not loving kindness. The Buddha never trusted love. He did trust goodwill. Because he said with love, there are certain times when love will give rise to more love, and other times when love will give rise to hatred. You love somebody, somebody else mistreats that person, you're going to hate that person. There are times when hatred gives rise to hatred. You hate somebody and somebody else treats that person well, you're going to dislike that person too. My favorite one is this, there's times when hatred gives rise to love. There's somebody you hate and you miss, and somebody else mistreats that person, you love that person. So, you love the person who mistreated the person you hate. Yeah, okay. So you can't trust love. Goodwill, though, is an expression of wishing that the person will understand the causes for happiness and will act on them. Because we're looking at goodwill in the context of karma. You can't think that I'm sitting here spreading goodwill to this person and that person will be happy. Or that my wish for that person's happiness will cause happiness. What I'm wishing for is, may that person understand the causes of happiness and act on them. You're working through the principle of karma. Years back, there was a woman in San Francisco who occasionally would call me. She usually studied with the Tibetans. But every now and then she felt needed a little dose of Theravada, so she called me up. And she was having trouble with her landlord. The landlord was going to sell their apartment complex. And he was going around trying to get each of the tenants to sign a statement, basically falsifying the amount of rent they were paying. I forgot whether it was to raise it or lower it, but for some reason he wanted falsification. And she said, I didn't want to do this, I don't know what to do, so I'm sitting here spreading thoughts of goodwill to him, I'm imagining him in a big house with a swimming pool and lots of girlfriends. And I said, no, that's not what you want. Think of this person being wise and generous and, you know, virtuous. That's goodwill. And secondly, band up with the other tenants and say no. She said, that's what I like about you, Theravadins. Down to earth. So goodwill is wishing that people will act on the causes of happiness. And that's something you can wish for anybody. It's not a prayer, it's a determined prayer. It's a determination. You're making a vow, I've got to develop this quality. And you're not doing it because we are all one. You're doing it because you need goodwill for your own goodness. If you can't have goodwill for people that you're dealing with, even difficult people, it's going to be very difficult to act skillfully around them. So you need to keep reminding yourself, no matter how much of a bastard this bastard is, I can't let that get in the way. And we're not denying that the people are bastards. There are some pretty bad people out there. But you want to say, okay, if somebody's really bad, you're basically wishing that they will change their ways. And then you say, okay, so something I can do positively to help that person change his or her ways. And if there's nothing, that's when you have to develop equanimity, at least for the time being. So those are some of the clearing up of a few misunderstandings around goodwill. Compassion is basically goodwill applied to people you know are suffering or who are doing things that will cause suffering. In other words, you have to have compassion for people who are acting in a skillful way. And here again, the wish is, what can I do to help them? How would it stop? Empathetic joy is goodwill for people who are happy or are doing things that are causes for happiness. You see someone acting in a very skillful way, you see them being generous, you see them being virtuous, and you feel happy for them. And equanimity is for cases where it's beyond your control to do anything. Now notice, all these have to be understood within the context of karma. And goodwill is not going to short-circuit karma. And so you're hoping for people to act in skillful ways. And when you're extending thoughts of equanimity, that's for cases where, one, you can't do anything about the situation right now. And the fact that you're not wasting your time on things that you can't change, it allows you to focus on the things you can. What can I do now? What is open to me now? So you learn to see these things as good qualities develop, even as because otherwise other people are saying, or someone yells at you and you just walk away. Because you realize, okay, if I say anything, that's going to be bad. So you walk away. Okay, you didn't lose. That's such a bad perception. Okay, if I let them get away with saying that horrible thing, I've lost. There are times when you have to let them say, they get them saying, let them get away with it. You've got to maintain your lack of ill will and also learn that you're not going to act on the anger that may come up. Any questions on that part? Yes.
I think that sadness is a form of ill will.
No.
No. Wrong.
Where'd you hear that?
I don't know. So I'm just curious about sadness.
Okay, with sadness, I mean, you're going to feel sadness naturally over something. And the Buddha says, you know, when there's a grief comes up and you feel the need to express it, go ahead and express it until you realize, okay, I'm getting self-indulgent. And that's why I said, look, I've got other things I've got to do.
So sadness is not considered a hindrance until it becomes
self-indulgent. Yeah. Because, you know, if you don't allow yourself to express it, you know, even the Buddha knew. Even back then, they knew, okay, it's going to get bottled up and it's going to be bad for you down the line. But at the same time, you have to realize, okay, what is it that's causing you sadness? You know, there's a sense of identification of some kind with whatever that was. There's a me in there someplace that's feeling wounded. And even you say, well, I'm sad for so-and-so. Well, there's a little bit of you in so-and-so. There's that passage where Sariputta says, you know, I was sitting and meditating and the question came up, is there any change in the world that would cause me grief and sadness? And I realized there wasn't. Ananda's sitting and listening. He says, wait a minute, what if anything happened to the Buddha? Wouldn't you feel sad? And Sariputta said, I'd see it was unfortunate that such a great being had passed away and could have done so much more good for beings, but that's it. And Ananda's response is interesting. He says, that shows there's no sign of I am, the conceit I am in you. Because that's where the sadness comes in. I identify with that particular person or that particular situation. But it's not your will.
So where does what will often be called aversion fit into the hindrance scheme then? Aversion for situations, aversion for thoughts that I wish I didn't have, aversion for things or places.
Well, the funny thing is, aversion doesn't fit into the hindrances.
It doesn't.
No. The only hindrance there is ill will. Because you are allowed to have aversion to certain thoughts. You're sitting there meditating. And here comes a thought of restlessness again. So I'm sick and tired of this restlessness. That's perfectly fine.
But what about, for instance, if I'm sitting and meditating and the thought that I have that horrible piece of work waiting for me to do afterwards, that is going to hinder my concentration. So.
Okay, at that point, you just say, well, that's just a distracting thought. That's more anxiety than it is aversion. Something's going to happen that I'm not looking forward to. That would come out of the restlessness and anxiety part.
What about aversion for inanimate objects that you can't, stay in goodwill for?
Such as?
Aversion towards the place where you're meditating, the smells around you, or
Okay, here we're backing up to a piece of meditation instruction that the Buddha gave Rahul that often gets forgotten. There was one time the Buddha was going to be teaching breath meditation to Rahula, and before he did, he started out by saying, make your mind like earth. In other words, you've got to develop patience, endurance. They throw disgusting things on the earth, and the earth doesn't shrink away. Make your mind like fire. Fire has to burn garbage, but it doesn't shrink away. So that's just kind of a ground clearing thing about your aversion to the places.
So if we were trying to fit it into the hindrance scheme, then would it the longer we need a sense desire then? You're desiring an opposite.
Well, you're desiring, the opposite of what you got. Yeah. But then, and then the next question is, how do I deal with this? And here again, the perception comes in. The big problem, of course, is the person next door suddenly decides they're going to turn out their stereo, try out their stereo full blast. And you say, how am I going to get away from this? And you have to think, okay, my sounds are one thing, my body is something else. And I can't pretend that the sounds are not there, but I'm just going to stay with the bodily sensations. And this is where the image of the screen comes in. You know, the wind is going to go through the screen. The screen doesn't catch the wind. And the wind doesn't move the screen around. I'm just going to be right here, and I'll let the sound just go right through me. And I found that to be very effective. There was one of the monasteries that I would stay in when I went to Bangkok had a little rice porridge store right next to the monastery. It liked to open up at 4 a.m. And all, you know, the tuk-tuks they have in Bangkok? Those little loud things. All the tuk-tuk drivers would come there at 4 a.m. to get their rice porridge. And occasionally they like to turn the stereo on full blast to let everybody know they're open. So you had the tuk-tuks and the stereo. And here I was trying to meditate. This is where I came up with the image of the screen. So I could just let it go right through. It doesn't have to affect me. Yes?
I noticed that, you know, I experience a lot of ill will, but I noticed that it's often fear that's underlying it, and I would imagine that kind of, I'm also very anxious, so there's a kind of a combination here. So the anger and the ill will is what presents itself first, but then when I examine it more closely, it is anxiety. So, does that matter? I guess in the sense of really getting to the root of what hindrance this is, or is it okay that it's kind of a
if
combo?
It can be a combo, and then when it's a combo, you may say, I may use more than just the one recommended technique or recommended antidote. Okay. Not all fear is bad. Mm-hmm. The fear of doing something unskillful, that's actually motivates the practice. Mm-hmm. I may have told you that story about the Eskimo shaman that was being interviewed. I forgot the name of the guy. He was an anthropologist back at the beginning of the 20th century. He was half Danish and half Greenlander. So he had some Eskimo blood in him. And he was interviewing an Alaskan Eskimo shaman about his religious beliefs. And the shaman asked him a few questions. And, hey, you know, it's not that we believe in something. We're afraid. And we have to work with our fears. A lot of Buddhism is based on, okay, my fear of doing something unskillful because the suffering that will come. So that kind of fear is okay. The other kinds of fears, well, I'm attached to X and I'm afraid that I'm going to lose this or whatever. That you've got to look at. Well, that's actually unskillful because of the attachment, not because of the fear, per se. Yes?
I appreciate your expression of aversions not seem to so well, because I read the sutta. The Buddha was once with a yaka, a bigfoot named Eagle Hare. And Eagle Hare said, are you averse to me? And Buddha said, yes. And I thought, well, the Buddha doesn't have unwholesome emotions, but aversion is not unwholesome.
But who would like to have a, you know, needle-haired yaksha coming right next to him? Wants to watch. Someplace. This is the problem with having robes. It's there someplace.
The
little hair
guy.
It was in my pocket.
So could you talk a little bit about desire of a sensual desire is a hindrance, but sensual enjoyment doesn't have to be. I mean, if we're enjoying the flowers, that's a sensual enjoyment.
Yeah. But it's when it starts becoming craving. We have to have the flowers just so.
Okay.
And it has to be this way, it has to be that way. Then you've got a problem. Because there are passages in the canon where Mahagassapa, who was probably one of the fiercest and sternest of the monks, talks about enjoying the beauties of nature. Mm-hmm. You know, in fact, it's some of the first wilderness poetry that we know was written. Because prior to that, when they described the beauties of the countryside, it was cultivated countryside. you're saying the wilds are really, really pretty. Mm-hmm. And your ability to enjoy that actually helps you get you out there into the wilds and makes it easier to meditate. I had a friend who was a Zen monk for a while. He was telling me a story about Chogyam Trungpa. Now, I don't have much use for Chogyam Trungpa. But one cool thing he would do was, and he would go to Zen monasteries where everything was just so. Yeah. He would bump into the scroll.
Yeah.
Knock it off kilter a little bit. And bump into the table here a little bit, and the flowers wouldn't be quite so nice. And I kept thinking, yes.
On the desire, and you go in the market, for instance, and you can see some chocolates. Mm-hmm. It's not like a BMW or something very expensive. You can have chocolates, mm-hmm. and then you can also buy flour or just little thing that you like. Is it really bad or desire instead of buying the something you don't like at the market?
You don't have to make a practice of going down and buying parsnips just because. Sorry. But if it's something that's going to actually, you know, you eat it and it's going to cause you harm, then you got a problem. And the object itself is not the problem; it's the extent to which you are driven by that desire.
This question of quantity: if you just get one sometimes, it's okay.
It's okay. Yeah.
It's just if you buy 6 kilos, that's.
Yeah, then you've got a problem. So should we take a short break?
Yes.
We'll be back here at 3:30.